If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
あ、ここいるんだ。
本当？見えないでしょ？どこにいるのかな？見えない。
あ、こんな
ところ。
あ、こんなところ。あ、見せ。
I've been obsessively playing Super Mega Baseball 2 all week. I just did a video on Golf Story. I'm in the middle of editing a video about the first Tony Hawk game. So I've been really thinking about how certain sports games accurately simulated the best aspects of those sports. Super Mega Baseball 2 has the best grip on what I like so much about baseball. The feeling of a batter whiffing on a pitch, the anticipation of a high fly ball rising towards the fence, just gets over the edge before the crowd loses it, that sort of thing. That is Joe Bush. In fact, he wrote something for us on Waypoint pretty recently, and that is actually from a forum post called Games That Captured the Spirit of Something You Love on the Waypoint forums. And of course, this is Waypoint Radio. It's episode 157, and joining me today is one person, and one person only. It is the one and only Rob Zachney.
I think I'm pretty much all you need to capture the spirit of what you love about Waypoint, if I'm being honest. Like, yeah, it's basically just me here, and yeah. we're sort of hanging out in an empty room. But I think I definitely am the super mega baseball version of Waypoint Radio compared to the full panel's MLB The Show.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. It's not Idle Weekend, but it's Waypoint Radio, and it's the two of us. Austin is still doing E3 stuff, pre-E3 stuff, I think is what it's called. I forget what it's actually called.
Judge's Week.
Yeah, he is being a judge. Austin's being a judge. Patrick is on vacation. Danica is also doing super secret experiments. And Natalie is graduating. So it's the two of us here today holding down the fort. And we're talking about something that I think is a really fun thing to talk about. So, obviously, we're doing a forum topic again, but it's just such a darn good topic that I thought it would be a fun one to talk about. So, obviously, Joe Bush here is talking about sports games, but the question is a little more open-ended. It's about any game that really captures the essence of something that you love, sort of in the real world or in another context, which I think is cool and open and broad. And, of course, sports games are a really good way of sort of opening that up. So I guess I will start with one example that is also a sports game thing. And just in the spirit of the question, we can open it up, of course, more from there. But I really love, actually, the grappling model in UFC Sports 3. I think that's the one that I've played. The one that actually came out this year. Which, you know, the game is interesting. It's pretty good. I had some issues with it, certainly. I had some issues with the sort of fame aspect and how that is sort of monitored, and also the fact that Conor McGregor is on the front of that package, and dude hasn't fought in the UFC in a while at this point. And there's a whole lot of bullshit going on there. I guess unless you count him, you know, throwing things at a bus full of fighters as a fight. It was him versus that bus.
It's even been a while since the Mayweather thing, right?
Yeah, like, it was almost a year ago.
Yesterday's news.
Yeah, so. That was like last July, I believe. Possibly yeah. August. It's been the better part of a year. And I'm not his biggest fan. I think he's a great fighter, but, you know, really does not conduct himself all that well otherwise. So, yeah, all right. But the grappling in that game is awesome. It actually gets somewhat at the feeling of the push and pull that is grappling, which, as I said in the piece I wrote about it, and also truly think this is the case, grappling is the most fun you can have with your body with your clothes on. I will hold to that forever. It is one of the most fun things you can do. It's super hyper intense. It's fighting, but it's also like this just wonderful, just battle of wills, and wills and skills, I guess you could call it. And the game does it well.
How does that game bring that to life is what I've always sort of, because to me, like, everything about grappling sounds so about physicality, so much about, like, I don't know. It just seems like an impossible thing to simulate, but I don't play games like this, and I certainly don't grapple. So, like, how do you get that mix of the physicality and then, like, the mental chess aspect of it across in a game where your modes of expressing yourself are buttons and joysticks?
Right. Well, it's never going to be as good as the real thing. I should say that, of course, up top. It's not as awesome as doing it for real, but... it does a good job of at least simulating that chess aspect, which is to show it in the normal mode. It basically shows the kind of rock, paper, scissors. Oh, this move might be good against this move. This move might be good against this move. That kind of idea. So, like, this is a good counter move versus this is a good way of getting out of the guard versus I should probably stop speaking gibberish here to people who don't grapple. So in the rock, paper, scissors kind of model, it's you know, obviously one move will be a good counterattack to something versus one thing will be weak to something else. That just sort of general idea. So you're always kind of moving in between positions, and you're doing that in normal grappling as well. You're sort of in a position and you're thinking about either defending an attack or attacking like a body part, say going for an arm bar or a choke or something like that. And there's always going to be moves that are effective against that as the sort of the counter to that. Or, the defense against that. And there's also going to be things that it gives you an opportunity to do a counterattack against it. So it gets at that feeling of constantly shifting positions and constantly finding those opportunities for both offense and defense, which I think is pretty cool. And it's a little slow, which is also fairly realistic. Obviously, when you see really high-level grapplers, it is sometimes ridiculously fast, especially smaller people, because they're doing all these wild things. You know, they have ridiculous balance, and they're kind of going from thing to thing to thing, especially no-gi. Or in, like, you know, the UFC, there's no gis at this point. Everybody's kind of wearing their underwear a little bit. So it is fast, but... it's not fast the way that boxing is fast. It's not fast the way that kickboxing is fast. It is much more about sort of establishing dominant positions. So it can take a little while. It can take a little while. There's almost like a grind to it. And that's simulated really, really well with kind of the speed and the weight and the way it's deliberate when you're pressing these buttons and handling the joystick.
That doesn't end up feeling like inscrutable. Because, like, the comparison I'm making in my head is, it always seemed like a cool system. I just never had the patience to really master it. Metal Gear Solid 4, the CQC model. Which I think is introduced by literally the character being like, Snake, how's your CQC? but what I remember about it...
I gotta look this up, because I have no idea what this is.
So Metal Gear Solid 4, in addition to like having all these stealth mechanics and all these like these shooter elements, these nonlinear shooter elements, it also had a surprisingly detailed branching like hand-to-hand combat interface where like you could have really granular hand-to-hand engagements with other characters. And to my memory, and it's possible this is totally, I was drunk at a friend's house. So like, like my capacity to engage with the system was pretty minimal at that point. I basically turned to the guy and was like, I can just shoot these guys. Right. And he was like, yeah, just shoot them, bro. And I did. I shot all of them. My snake was pretty bloodthirsty. But the thing that stayed with me is, like, it looked a lot, especially when he showed me him doing it, and like, it looked a lot like cool action movie fights or something. But it also seemed like, for however cool it was on the screen, actually interacting with it was going to be this very, much like a fighting game, this inscrutable, like, combo system that doesn't necessarily feel like much of anything. It's more a matter of internalizing this unintuitive Simon Says routine.
Yeah. Obviously when you're working with that kind of that level of obfuscation, it's definitely there's always that risk. And there's entirely possible you can actually sort of basically turn off the grappling and put it in like an easy mode and just play with, you know, sort of buttons and not the positional stuff or the sort of, you know, tweaking the stick a little bit to show, you know, to sort of add or subtract strength to what you're putting something in. Or it's hard to explain exactly, but part of the reason I probably like it is that I do it in real life, so I'm already mapping a lot of that stuff and I'm filling in those gaps a little bit. I could totally imagine this being like, what the fuck ever, boring as shit.
But with your real world knowledge, you can translate what the game is offering you into concepts that you're familiar with from doing like in real world.
I like to think so. And like, I should also say, like, I'm still a white belt. Like, I'm a white belt with a stripe. Like, I'm not like a black belt master, amazing, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioner, but I sure do love it. I've been training it for like a year and a half, and I sure do love it. So hopefully my enthusiasm carries me through some of that as well, for sure. For sure. So what is, do you have a sporty example, or would you like to sort of open this up into other games that sort of capture a feeling or capture some element of a real life thing that feels great to play?
Well, yeah, it's weird. I think sports are probably the natural one that occurs to you here, because playing a game, like a good sports game, has to capture something about the spirit of an activity, or like, because that's all it can capture, right?
Yeah.
Like, it has to bring across the feeling of playing a game or watching a great competition on TV, because it can't, like, there's no way a game can like actually make the act of like shooting a three-pointer feel like landing one of those shots actually feels. So like I'm struggling to think of stuff beyond sports, really, because like, I mean, obviously my go-to is like racing games.
Yeah.
Particularly, I would say, like, when the F1 series has been at its best, it has done a very good job of channeling not just the way I imagine racing an F1 car feels, but also the entire weird community rituals, politics of racing sometimes feel as well. So, you know, the idea that like after you completely screw up a race or something, you have to go talk to the press, and you'll have like David Croft there or something asking you basically about why did you suck so badly in that race. And you know, you got like three options or something, where it's, you know, basically like say something shitty to the journalist, don't say anything at all, or just say like, yeah, for sure, and leave. and like that will have ramifications. But I love that the like, yeah, for sure option is there, because like the minute you see that, you realize like, damn, those guys do basically like blow off a lot of questions like that by just going like, yeah, no, totally.
You got it, bud.
yeah, because like there's nothing to say, so all you can do is sort of back away slowly from the question and answer with kind of a meaningless affirmation. So yeah, I mean, trying to get it beyond sports here for a minute. And I'm completely failing at the moment.
Like, that's
I suppose. Military history, for instance, is something I really enjoy.
Yeah.
And my favorite war games increasingly are about things that model problems beyond just the sort of stuff you can easily chart on a map. So, like, to give you an example, a lot of war games are about turning an enemy flank, right? Like sending units around to the flank and getting an advantage and sort of using that to leverage open an enemy position, break it apart, and then roll them up. That's kind of a basic move in a lot of war games. It's the basic move in, like, basically that is the entire name of the game in Total War, you know?
Yeah.
Be somebody with the last troops on the field and go around to the flank and have that sort of advantage as the full weight of your line hits the few guys on the end of their line. It becomes like an almost simple physics problem. But that is increasingly not what interests me, and so increasingly I gravitate toward war games that are more about intangible elements, the things that you can't just diagram and say, like, well, obviously here is where so-and-so should have flanked, you know, in, you know, 1864 or something like that, or 1871. And so I really do, like, you know, I'm inclining a lot toward games like the Take Command series, which is entirely about being sort of middle management of a battle in a lot of cases, but not being the person in charge, and certainly not being the person with like this God's eye view of the battle who can do everything. It's mostly about like literally you turn your camera to the right and you're kind of looking at it and it's like, are those enemy reinforcements showing up like behind us? Is that Is that a problem? And then you sort of look at, like, the allied troops over there, and, like, because this literally happens in this game. You'll have, like, AI commanders next to you in line. And so you'll sort of be nervously, like, checking what they're doing and how they're doing it. And occasionally you'll start to look at it and you'll realize, like, oh, man, they are completely blowing this. Like, they're, like, in 5 minutes, they're basically going to be, like, shot to shit. And then I'm going to be completely exposed and alone here. So what do I do with that? Do I continue with the original plan, with what my orders say? Or do I acknowledge the reality I'm seeing on the field and sort of shit can my orders and just try to do the best I can here? And that dilemma is something that actually comes up way more often in history, right? Like, when you read things, it's not that people are idiots and couldn't do the obvious thing or couldn't read a map. A lot of times the real dilemma in military history, but, you know, in any sort of collective human pursuit, the issues are actually ones of, like, coordination and understanding and information. And so games that bring that across increasingly fascinate me, because those seem like games that are about living an event through the eyes of its participants, which is really irresistible to me.
Yeah. Absolutely. That feels like a lot of what is interesting about history in every context of, like, being there, that immersion factor. Speaking of immersion factor, this might have a little bit more to do with sort of animation and responsiveness to mechanics, but here's another thing I've been doing a lot of lately in my life is swimming. I started swimming this year, like at the new year, basically. I took some classes for grown-ups at the Y. You know, I learned as a kid, but, you know, I've been taking proper swimming classes for stroke mechanics, basically. And appreciating good swimming in games. Rise of the Tomb Raider. I think it was Rise of the Tomb Raider, right? The sequel is Rise of the Tomb Raider. I want to make sure. Let's make sure. Let me do a little Googleations here. Rise of the Tomb Raider. Yeah, that's the one.
What was the first one?
What was the first one? It was like, it wasn't just Tomb Raider, was it?
No, that seems.
It was like something it, Tomb Raider.
It was, well, here,
I know Rise of the Tomb Raider is the, yeah.
Oh, it was.
It was just
Tomb
called
Raider.
Tomb Raider. Okay.
I hate video game names so much. Like, literally for the last year, like, I've been thinking Rise of the Tomb Raider was the first game in the series. And I was like, but what was the second one called? What was that second? Like, okay.
It's, oh, God, yes.
We're all soft reboots now.
That's the next conversation we have on Waypoint Radio. Fucking just a tirade against game
titles. You can't go from
yeah.
Battlefield 1 to Battlefield 5. God damn
it. It's an issue. It's such an issue. It communicates nothing. God. Anyway, Rise of the Tomb Raider, which I still think is one of the best video game ass video games of this generation in terms of, like, I think it's a lot more fun than most of the Uncharted games, even though I liked the sort of Uncharted side story that came out last year. I thought that was really fun. But I think it feels a lot better in terms of the actual traversal mechanics. It feels sort of weightier in a way and also sort of slippery in the right way, especially if you're literally, you know, sort of walking around in mud or sort of slippery. Like climbing crevasses, I suppose, or which sort of traverses. The swimming animation is amazing in that game. There's like a real sense of just how not just the speed, but also the sort of languid motion of moving toward in water and the sort of desperation when you come up for air. There's something about that animation that feels very, very, very weighty. In the right way. Like, I'm probably a similar size, I guess, to what Lara Croft is. So it sort of, like, speaks to me as, like, all right, it's kind of a small woman with some muscles, and this is how it feels to move in the water and kind of get out of the water. And there's that moment of, like, I am breathing again, and it is wonderful, especially if you spend a lot of time doing freestyle. Oh, my God, it feels amazing to breathe. There's definitely a sense of air hunger that you can get, especially if you've been swimming for quite a while. And it's really, really, really fantastic. And she also does this cute little thing where I don't have really long hair right now, but I obviously used to, where every time she gets out of the water, she kind of like wrings out her ponytail a little bit. Like it's this very yeah. just natural motion where she's just kind of like, all right, wring out the ponytail and onto the next, which just feels like a very, it's a small touch. It's not something anybody's ever going to spend, you know, years looking at and saying like, oh, here's the stroke of genius that made Rise of the Tomb Raider a great video game ass video game. But I think it's one of those small touches that really sells the moment and sells the character in that like chef's kiss kind of way. So
no, I totally get where you're coming from with that. Like, I mean, I've got like a friend of mine, like Sean Anderich over at Games with Jobs. He and I will still geek out years, and it's been like literal years, and we still talk about it. How much it meant to us that like when it started raining in The Witcher 1, people would run for like the eaves of buildings.
Yeah.
And like town squares would just empty out and people would just sort of huddle in like doorways and under like, you know, rooftops. And that was really, really cool. And like just little like lifelike details like that are great.
Yeah, they just really sell like the sense of space and place and being there and the idea of this world as it's real. It's not just a collection of simulated elements and art assets and animation and scripting that all just kind of happens. It just gives it that extra little oomph to make something feel real.
You know, it's got some good swimming.
Oh, what has some good swimming?
Donkey Kong Country Tropical
Freeze. Oh, yeah. It sure does. Are you still playing that game?
It is a small thing.
Oh, yeah.
But the way that Donkey Kong gets those like moves with these little bursts of speed and then slows down. Yeah. And then burst of speed with each kick of his legs, and that motion continues, feels so good and convincing in a weird way. And like the way he can't just turn in the water, but has to do like a little like sort of dive turn to spin around and get facing the other direction. It is such a cool thing and sells the illusion incredibly effectively. That like this is a real environment and this character has like weight and inertia. Also the fact that music changes when you go underwater is amazing.
Yes.
The
it's music, so good.
The way the music changes and like when you get one of his little sidekicks, one of the other members of the Donkey Kong family, the way they like add their own riff onto whatever the main theme is super cool.
Oh, it's so good.
But yeah. It's funny. Anyway, good swimming.
Hell yeah, good swimming. And actually, it's a little bit funny. That was one of the main selling points of that game. Like, nobody besides me paid any attention to the, like, pre-release press on that game. But I was all for it, because of course I was. Swimming was a thing that they were like, there was actually no swimming, I don't think, in Donkey Kong Country Returns, the sort of Wii reboot of the series. And swimming was always really fun. It was something people remembered really fondly from the old games. And there just wasn't, it just was an element that wasn't in the new, the reboot. So they were, when they introduced the swimming stuff, it sure was a thing. Like that E3, like 2013 E3 or whatever it was. And they were like, oh, you can swim again. And I was like, oh my God, you can swim again. Everybody else is like, why isn't it Metroid? Great, you can swim again, but why isn't it Metroid? And that's why people are jerks. But yeah, it's so beautiful.
Should Donkey Kong have a gun? Is that the...
Yeah, right? Like, I mean, you want to give him a suit? Like a space suit?
He's already got cannons. Well, cannon barrels.
Donkey Kong Country on the moon with, like, different physics for jumping?
That would be super cool.
Would be that amazing. Would. All right.
I would
Retro Studios.
Literally, all I remember about the earlier Donkey Kong games, by the way, is mine carts. Like, literally, my only vision. Like, when I think, like, man, I remember really liking Donkey Kong Country. And the only thing I see is, like, racing around in mine carts. Basically, it was, like, subterranean Sonic is how I remember that game. I don't think that was how that game was, but it's what I remember.
I mean, there was a mine cart level in every world, I think. Maybe there wasn't in World 1.
Okay, actually. So there were like... So it's not just me. There was a shit ton of minecarts.
There were plenty. Let's call it 5 or 6, because there are only like 6 or 7 worlds, and I think the first world did not have a minecart level, if I'm not mistaken. I think the first one is in World 2. I played a lot of this game.
Oh, so
but yeah, there were several. It wasn't just one. There were several of these levels, yes.
I mean, actually, the more I think about this question, the more like I'm starting to like go expanding brain on the entire thing, and like actually no, like all games capture the essence of something I love, but I think I was thinking about maybe because we talked about it on the show a couple weeks ago, but the original Arkham Asylum.
Yes.
Which with that original game and the original like voice acting team, and it was written by Paul Dini. Basically, the original Arkham Asylum played like a really, really good and involving episode of Batman the Animated Series. Hmm. Stylistically, it was totally different. Like, it didn't look remotely like Bruce Timm's artwork, which was a major, major part of like why the original animated series was so good. But nevertheless, like in terms of tone, the characterizations, that entire thing sort of felt familiar as a fan of Batman the Animated Series, which was like, that probably is and always will be like my Batman, as far as I'm concerned. Like, it was Batman the Animated Series, and then like the stuff that Greg Rucka and Ed Brubaker were writing in the late 90s. But what was so important about that is what the animated series eventually turned into, because the characters would see each other again and again and again, is after a point, it was about exposing the essential elements of these characters and their relationships. Like, I think it's in the animated series where, like, you start actually seeing plot lines really digging into how shitty the relationship between like Harley and the Joker is. Like, Harley starts out as a complete joke, but I swear to God, it was in that series even where you started having people pointing out like, yo, this guy treats you like shit. Like, thing like that starts becoming an element in that series. You start having a lot of the ongoing relationships and conflicts between these characters carried from one episode into the next. Like, it wasn't serial storytelling, but like the weight of history with these characters got heavier each time they encountered each other and sort of evolved those relationships. And I think Arkham Asylum kind of works on that level because it presumes a lot of like understanding of who these characters already are. You're sort of meeting them when they've already sort of been to this dance a bunch of times before. And this is the latest and most dramatic, like, final showdown between these characters. But it definitely felt like a continuation of some of those conflicts you saw arise in the animated series.
Yeah. It was also really fun to swing around in that game.
Oh, it was super good.
I guess it wasn't really swinging as much as it was sort of shooting from point to point with the God, what was it called? It's not the batarang. The
grappling hook.
The grappling thing. Yeah,
it's just the grappling hook. I don't think it's the bat. Okay. I don't think it's like the batnel or anything like that.
The batling hook is
no.
No. Okay. All right.
I mean, thank God it's not. That'd be lame. No, I mean, that's the other thing, though, is, like, the later games, because it moved to the open world stuff, they basically turned Batman into, like, someone who could fly. Like, he'd just get up in the tall places and, like, jump, and then his cape would let him, like, glide through the city. But I think, Arkham Asylum is the most it felt like being Batman, right? Where, like, you couldn't fly, but you could, like, sort of float pretty far. And most of what you did was sort of drop out of the shadows, pounce on somebody, wreck them, and then vanish.
That game was really good. I feel like we don't do as much of this anymore. We used to do kind of retrospectives on games, and it'll be 10 years next year, actually, for Arkham Asylum, which is bananas to think about.
Shit, I need to start working on that then.
I know, right? Well, you've got a year to do it. Man, that was a really good game.
I am looking up now. This is driving me nuts. I want to say it's in the original animated series where you have the episode where Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy basically like have a felonious girls' night, I guess is the way to put it.
Where
Ivy like seriously like eventually hits a breaking point and grabs Harley and is like, let's just get out of here. Like, let's get away from the shitty dude. And it turns into a vaguely Thelma and Louise kind of thing.
Hell yeah. I know in the comics now there is definitely like an actual flirtation.
I think it actually graduated to the point of like an entire like queer storyline.
Perfect.
Around those two.
A thing I will need to read. I don't read much or many superhero comics, but I, you know.
No, 100%. This totally happens.
Oh, that's excellent.
Yep, it was written by Paul Dini. Nice. who wrote Arkham Asylum.
Oh, that's fantastic. Very good, very good.
That show owned. And so did that game.
Things that owned. I'm trying to think of a good segue. But I guess sometimes our questions own.
They
and
do.
Those are really good.
And sometimes we get owned via the questions.
Well, often, in fact. There's a really good question right here from Column. And Column writes, I should ask if there are any other specific sort of elements we want to chat about before we go into the question book, of course. Oh, I do have one. One last one. And of course I have to because it's Prey. Microgravity in Prey. It's real good. Feels great. Oh,
yeah.
So good. Anyway, do you have any other ones?
No, I'm just reading the summary of this episode and I'm like, yeah, this is really good. Like, Joker is unfairly blaming Harley for one of his fuck-ups, and then Poison Ivy's like, he doesn't treat you right. This guy's garbage.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, it's good.
I would like to watch that. I'm gonna watch that. I'm gonna read those comics. I'm gonna do more things they own. And Column here has a very good question about things that may own or may not own, basically. So Column writes, hello, Waypoint. I was wondering if there are any games you absolutely love but also acknowledge are bad/broken, broken enough as games to not actually feel comfortable recommending them to other people. The example that always comes to mind for me is Space Station 13, the free-to-play multiplayer sandbox game. It's still the best multiplayer experience I've ever had. It is a game that manages to jump back and forth between genres every round and has absurd amounts of mechanical depth. However, it's also a truly terribly made game, created on an engine that was never made to do what the game tries to do, has awful netcode, looks like garbage visually, and is a nightmare to get into without being willing to read through half a dozen wiki guides. I adore this game. It is easily on my greatest game of all time list. It is also a dumpster fire. Could never in good faith suggest that anybody ever play it, no matter how much I would want to. Does the Waypoint crew have any similar games among their all-time favorites? Peace, Column. Well, Column, you've come to the right place.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like we might have to ask this again when Austin is on the podcast, because he is the king of liking things that might be a little broken, but they're interesting. But Rob, do you have any specific examples of this or anything jumped
dude,
in mind?
Yes. Let me just open up my dumpster of like beloved trash and just start pulling some wrappers out for you. The other night I was playing Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl.
Yeah.
And I'm still working on a thing about that, because there's this, like, look, it is way too early to get excited about Stalker 2, because, like, what they're proposing is, I think, a 2021 release date, is a pretty long time for things to go wrong in game development, particularly when this is a franchise that, like, famously kind of imploded. And there was a lot of bad blood left between a lot of the original stakeholders, as I understand it. So I'm not as much as I would love Stalker 2, I'm not getting my hopes too high about it, but it did move me. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, there's also the fact we might not live to 2021. Like,
I certainly might not make it.
I mean, I want to. I'm just saying, like, if humanity makes it to 2021.
God knows what the state of the world will be in 2021.
Yeah.
That's for sure. It's possible we'll all be engaged in, like, a Stalker LARP at that point. And we'll no longer need Stalker 2 because we're all Stalkers now.
Rob, that's the real game. That's it. That's what it is.
I'd be okay with that. I think I would. I don't know. I have complicated feelings about that future, but I suppose that's because I'm not being realistic. Like, in my head, I'm like, I would totally be one of the people who survived the apocalypse and, like, just started thriving out there, you know, on the open range with my Kalashnikov and my anti-rad medications.
And your guitar.
I definitely wouldn't be somebody who was, like, murdered by looters in the first, like, 36 hours or, like, eaten by cannibals in the first 3 months. That wouldn't happen to me. Anyway. No, Shadow of Chernobyl is... I can't recommend you just play vanilla Shadow of Chernobyl. It's one of those games where I'm like, okay. So you should absolutely play Stalker, but you definitely should first do some investigation as to whether or not you want the Stalker Complete mod or whether you want the Zone Reclamation Project mod. What Stalker experience do you want? Because the vanilla experience has got a lot of broken shit in it. And then there's two real schools of thought about how you fix that. Stalker Complete makes for a really, really gorgeous game and has some nice quality of life improvements. But Zone Reclamation Project is, like, supposedly the fixed version of the vanilla game. But then there's a ton of options within that, and do you want those? Like, within 5 minutes of opening Stalker the other day, I had to open up the console commands and kill the head bob because it was making me sick. And, like, games do not make me motion sick, and this one, like, almost had me on the floor within 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
And then, even if you get past all that... The game throws you up against, like, multiple brick walls right at the start. Like, I ended up playing... On Twitter, I said it was, like, 30 minutes. No, it was 30 minutes for the first time I beat the opening gunfight. It was, like, 90 minutes of trying to win the first encounter in this game. Because Stalker does not give a shit about you. Like, it does not... Like, this is not some... All right, like, here's the start of your progress toward becoming, like, a badass in this game. It is... You start out the game, someone hands you a trash pistol, and is like, can you go take out those bandits? And you're like, sure. And the pistol, like, can barely, like, it's got no power at range, and so, like, but neither do theirs, and so the fight just goes on forever as you and these bandits, like, completely futilely exchange fire from range. And, like, at a certain point, you start to realize, like, why am I even taking cover? Nobody can hit anything. Like, guys will be, like, loading shells into their shotguns and, like, blasting away at you from, like, 40 yards away. And, like, you'll hear the buckshot, like, scattering all around you, but, like, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. And so the battle just goes on and on while you and this, like, half-assed group of bandits try to fight each other, but there's still seven of them and one of you, and so chances are you'll die a lot. Or you'll run out of ammo and get killed because you're trying to, like, go in close and scavenge it off the bodies. And that is how Stalker opens. And I was talking about this on Twitter the other day, and, like, everyone remembers that fight because it might be the hardest single gun battle in all of Stalker, which is wild. Like, the hardest thing you will do in that game is basically
the very
a scrub
first thing.
Yeah, it is a scrub league match between, like, two garbage teams, and you cannot, like, it's impossible. But if once you get past it, it does make it a lot more meaningful the first time you get, like, an actual assault rifle. Like, the first time you get a battered old Kalashnikov, you're like, oh, now I'm the Terminator. Like, now I'm just gonna, you know, take these guys down. But yeah, so that's, like, everything about Stalker. You have to, like, front-load it with these caveats that it's like, well, okay, the game's totally broken, so actually first you need to spend, like, an hour or so figuring out which mods to install and how to install them. And then don't get discouraged if the game is totally nightmarishly impossible for the first 2 or 3 hours you play with it. It gets good, I promise. It's definitely worth all that trouble.
Oh, man. I just want to watch you play it. I think that's what I actually want. I don't think I... Because I'm so fascinated by this game. I love the film Stalker. I had, like, an amazing experience watching that at the Harvard Film Archive. Yes.
Major mechanic is you reach into your bag of rusted out bolts and you fling them in front of you to see if anything bad happens to them.
That sounds amazing!
Yeah,
yes!
No. Like, when I saw the movie and the guy, like, started flinging bolts into, like, an old field, I was like, holy shit. Holy shit.
There it is! There it is! Okay, can you just play it and I'll watch you play it?
Yeah, I think that can be arranged, actually.
All right, we can do that. We can do that. See, there we go. It's called streaming. I know, but still. Like, I still actually, not that I'm going to go off on this tangent, but I still think of things in the old school ways. Like, we could hot seat this when I, you know, kind of talk about, like, playing a game with my girlfriend. Like, that's how we play God of War and things like that.
We should
have
a sleepover and, like, you watch me play. Yeah, I mean, we should do that. We should totally do that. But also, yeah, I could just stream that and we could do that.
We could get content out of it. I guess we could either way, right? It's cool sleepover. I don't know. Anyway, I'm a child, but it's fine. I guess speaking of I'm a child, I was thinking a lot about this, and the answer to something that gave me a lot of joy, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone, would probably be Mario is Missing, the edutainment game from the early 90s. But actually, like, I think a better answer for this might be Sonic Adventure, a game that I actually think is kind of good. A little broken, a lot broken. Watch speedruns of that game. It's actually really fascinating.
Which
the way
one is
this game was
Sonic
constructed.
Adventure?
In the first 3D Sonic. Well, okay. The first 3D Sonic that was all 3D. I think there were 3D elements
wait,
in various Sonics before that.
Wait,
but like
is this
the first,
another
like,
one of those games that's on your island of misfit 3D platformers?
Yes.
Okay.
Kind of.
Continue.
I mean, so I'm not going to call this one, it's nowhere near as good as Mario 64 or Banjo-Kazooie or, you know, the latest iterations of 3D platformers that are actually pretty good. But I think it's good. I don't think it's, like, completely broken. It's broken, but good. It's one of those. I think it fits the criteria for this. So I actually did a guide to games on this. So I played it somewhat recently, like, during my tenure at Waypoint. And it's actually a really interesting, like, 3D platformer with these very bizarre sort of adventure elements and going to the right place. And the story is fucking bananas. And this is where a lot of, like, Sonic's shitty friends were actually introduced. Like, I am 99% sure this is Big the Cat's first game. Like, this is where Big the Cat had, like, a fishing mini game, basically. And a lot of things that would become horrid in later 3D Sonics were introduced here. Like, Sonic has fast levels, and other people have maybe less fast levels. But there's actually some really interesting level design here. Now, if you were a child of the era, this was like the launch Dreamcast game as well. So, of course, the Dreamcast was sold on Sonic running away from the whale, that famous, you know, sort of moment. But I think there's actually a lot of tricks up his sleeve that were pretty cool and interesting. And there's a very bizarre and interesting and weirdly constructed world here that I actually find really interesting and really cool. So I really like this game. I don't think it's great, and it is kind of broken in certain ways, but yeah, it's pretty cool. So I would call that not on my top 10 list of all time or anything like that, but very cool. Very cool game that is worth some consideration. And perhaps Sonic was misjudged, at least at this point. I mean, later on, things happened that maybe Sega's not proud of. But at this point, I think they still had things to be proud of.
You ever just look at pictures of Big the Cat and think, I do not like those hands?
Oh, yeah. Ever look at pictures of Sonic from that era and think, I do not like his hands? Because his hands are, like, as big as his face. Like, that 1999, like Sonic the Hedgehog, like, he's walking around and his legs are kind of, you know, doing a thing, and, like, his hands are just so massive. And also, if his hands are that far developed, why are his legs and feet not super developed?
They're
if he
very,
runs
like, pipe cleaner.
Yeah, he has these skinny little tiny legs, and it's like, that's where you want the muscle, not in your hands. But it would be, I don't know, it's interesting. It is interesting. Good old Sonic. We're not an anti-Sonic website, as much as, you know, people want to call it one way or the other. I don't think that's true. All right. Do you want to do some quick waypoints?
Yeah, I think we should. We can probably take one more letter. Like, we're so bad at the bucket, man. Is there? If you've got another one on deck, we can do it. Otherwise, happy to dive into waypoints.
All right, let's see. I think we got one more. I think we got one more letter here. Yeah, we got a good one. We got a real good one right here. This one comes from Francisco from Virginia. And we've got some stuff in here that actually is pretty relevant to other parts of our conversation. which is very good. Francisco says, after playing through God of War and reading through your article, The Long Take and This Is America underlines why God of War needed a cut. I was curious on your thoughts on video game camera directing. In particular, moments you really liked or disliked. I'll try not to spoil anything, but one thing I really appreciate that you can see in both God of War and Batman Arkham series is the idea of rendering a character out of your vision cone, kind of like seeing inside your character's psyche. In the most recent Arkham game, Arkham Knights, Batman is struggling through most of the game because of the death of the Joker, in Arkham City, several times. Oh, I didn't know that happened. All right, well, whatever. Several times through the game, you can see and even feel Batman start to lose his mind as he sees his dead nemesis throughout the world. Sometimes it scared the pants off of me. Other times, I thought I could feel the Joker looking in the background. I would turn the camera and see nothing, and then turn the camera back in front again and see the Joker right in front of me. Do you guys have any similar experiences with directing, playing with the idea of having the user control the camera, or just any specific moments in general where this idea really stood out to you? Love the show, and Francisco also has a really good side note here. Another great instance in the Arkham games is when Batman would grapple up the top of a building, come into contact with Man-Bat. Seriously, Man-Bat. He linked a picture, or they linked a picture, and scared the living daylights out of you.
Man-Bat is creepy.
Oh, Man-Bat. I only know what Lego Man-Bat looks like because I played the first Lego Batman. Man-Bat was in there, and it's, yeah, things happen there. But Rob, do you have a specific thought about a camera moment in a game?
Video game cameras, it's tough for me because there's a lot of well-directed games out there, like Naughty Dog in their cinematic sequences are really good at building a scene and controlling your attention because they're employing like really, you know, classic film techniques.
Yeah.
I'm struggling to think of like, I think it is cool when games mess with your sense of reality that way. Like for instance, the entire, like having Joker appear and disappear in places, or Spec Ops The Line played with stuff like that as well, where like you would sometimes be dealing with things that were not there, right? Like there's a sequence where you're in the middle of a gun battle in an old mall, I think, basically, and at some point you become convinced like you're getting rushed by guys, and then like the lights come up and there's mannequins that you've just been like wasting. But a minute ago, they weren't mannequins, and so you're kind of left with that. Another nifty thing that was done was that I think in the original Kane and Lynch, you could play the campaign co-op, and I'll stand up for Kane and Lynch and Kane and Lynch 2 till my dying breath. Another perfect examples of games that I would hesitate to actually recommend you, but I'm like, but they were awesome though. Like for all that they're shit, they're pretty awesome. But when you play the sort of precipitating debacle of Kane and Lynch is that you go on a routine bank heist and Lynch, you're basically completely criminally insane partner, has a meltdown midway through the heist and slaughters a bunch of people.
Oh.
And apparently, like, when you play that scene through from his perspective, like, over the course of that scene, as he loses touch with reality, like, you do start to see, like, all these people in this bank start to, like, become enemies. And so you're sort of put in the position of, like, you see them attacking you, and you sort of react, and then it's revealed that, haha, none of that was real. Maybe a problematic story element, who's to say? But nevertheless, like, was kind of nifty. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm always tickled by when games, the various ways games can sort of control your attention and pull it this way or that. I think the BioShocks were great at doing this. I think Fort Frolic in particular is very good at sort of creating these tableaus that you are meant to see. That, like, even though you can walk around them, you are still somehow in several places dancing to Sandra Cohen's tune and being forced to perceive his art the way he wants you to. He's arranged it. It's this curated experience through a level that is really, really cool.
Yeah. And the lighting, especially in that level, is it's just phenomenal and dramatic and beautiful. One thing I thought of the most for this question wasn't just sort of, the sort of traditional framing question, but more about cutting. I played a game recently called Paratopic that uses jump cuts and hard cuts. It's a horror game where you're playing in first person, and so, you know, your view is being directed a certain way, and you are sort of going through these motions. You're sort of a delivery person in this horrifying world, and you're going through, and there are moments where you're kind of walking around in first person, exploring things, maybe talking to people, and then you'll be smash cut into driving a car. And then all of a sudden you're driving this car down this sort of devilish highway. It definitely... It sort of takes from the 30 Flights of Loving idea, you know, using these hard cuts and using sort of jump cuts while you're playing a game, which is really cool and actually like such a cool idea. I'm kind of surprised more games haven't used this as a technique, but Paratopic does it brilliantly. 30 Flights of Loving uses it in a sort of zany and cartoonish and fun way, but Paratopic uses it in this really sort of terrifying and disjointed way to tell its kind of narrative. So I guess more of an editing technique than necessarily a camera technique, but still very, very effective, like cinematic language example in a game that I think is rad. All right. Let us now move to our waypoints for the week. Rob, is there something you've been watching or reading, or it's just something special, something you want to shout out?
So I have... Now I am now far enough along with this that I'm comfortable endorsing it. I have really gotten into Counterpart on Stars Showtime.
Okay.
I don't know, one of the premium channels. Who's to say? certainly who's not I. No, I'm good. Like, sorry for the keyboard. I had to look that up. Okay, it is. Yeah, it's a Stars show, and it stars J.K. Simmons. And it is this cool, it's got a very Tinker Tailor vibe to it. So, like, if you like Sad Spies, like, this is your shit. I love Sad Spies, so I'm all about this. But J.K. Simmons, like, plays this low-level, like, minor functionary in this mysterious Berlin spy agency in, like, what feels like... It feels like modern day, but also maybe just a little bit off-kilter enough where, you know, it sort of feels like a parallel modern day. It doesn't... It's weird. It doesn't entirely feel near future, and it doesn't entirely feel contemporary. I would say it sort of exists in sort of the... land of anachronism to a lesser extent, like that Legion inhabits in some ways, where like there's an aesthetic that sort of obscures exactly what tech level and when a story is taking place. But anyway, so he is this low level functionary in the spy agency, and there are all these like peculiar and weird rituals he has to observe, and that none of them really make any sense to him. And then he's the tail end of a completely like failed career. Like he's just an old nobody, sort of being put out to pasture. And then one day he is called in to deal with a potential defector from the other side, whatever the hell that means. And he goes into the room. It's somebody with a hood over his head. It's J.K. Simmons.
Oh shit!
And it is a very mean and murderous. Like super spy J.K. Simmons. And the entire idea of the show is that somewhere like 30 years ago, the timeline splits, and it splits in this like one particular part of Berlin where there's like a dimensional rift that opens up. And on one side, we have our continued history to our present day. And on the other side, there was a mirror world that has been slowly but steadily diverging from our own. And the main thing the show is about is people trying to figure out what is essential about their character. Like, in addition to all the spy stuff, which is cool and fun and definitely, like, scratches that itch, the really compelling part about it is people wrestling with the mystery of self and identity, right? Like, when you start to realize, like, maybe you are both more the product of circumstance than you think, and yet, at the same time, there are much more essential parts of you that sort of shine through no matter what your circumstances were. And that's kind of what the show is exploring. And I'm about halfway through, and it is super good.
Add it to the list. Just put it on the list. Pile it on. You know, I need that in my life as well. That sounds very good.
Oh, I should also say, like, Olivia Williams just fucking kills in the show as well. So she is his wife in one timeline and his estranged and also very badass super spy wife, ex-wife in another timeline. She is also doing some great, great work. So if you felt that she was a criminally underutilized asset in shows like Dollhouse, for instance, I don't know, she's getting some justice here.
Nice. Very good. I'd like to hear that. I am going to do a waypoint, because we're going to plug a Radio Motherboard episode, and that's going to be one of the waypoints. And I'll do a shorty, a little shorty boo, other waypoint for myself. But first, before I could forget, we have a Radio Motherboard episode that is relevant to the gamer interest. Let's call it, you know, the GI. I suppose the gamer...
GI is not, I mean...
Johnny Q Gamer. GI.
John Q Gamer.
GI Tract. John Q Gamer might be interested in this Radio Motherboard episode from just a couple days ago. It is titled Pod Void If Removed. And I'll read you the little description. You can find this, of course, on iTunes or wherever you get your fine podcasts. Radio Motherboard, of course. And the topic here is the FTC just announced that warranty void if removed stickers on video game consoles are illegal, which is a big win for consumers and an indication that the walled gardens of electronic manufacturers are being breached. So really cool story and a cool Radio Motherboard episode. Go listen to Radio Motherboard.
They've been doing a lot of cool reporting around that, around like right to repair issues and such. This was a really cool sort of change in policy that's transpired. So that's been cool to read about. I also really enjoyed related to that. Did you see the articles they wrote about farmers hacking their, I think it was John Deere tractors that have like really restrictive like firmware on them. And so that like people are getting around John Deere's like ploy to get them to bring it to a dealership.
Yeah. I saw a little bit of that, which
seemed really cool.
Wild and fascinating. Yeah. Motherboard just does really good stuff. They are, you know, sort of obviously that would be another Vice site, but they do some really, really cool reporting. And if you're interested as well in that sort of in the sticker story, there is a written story here. And the headline is FTC gives Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo 30 days to get rid of illegal warranty void if removed stickers, which is also cool. So check out that headline on Motherboard if you have a second, and definitely check out that John Deere farmer hacking story, because that is wild and really cool. Very, very, very cool stuff. So my other waypoint, my personal waypoint, I suppose, if you will, I'm gonna do a game that I have been obsessed with the last couple of days, and it's called Assemblance Oversight. And I'm not going to go on too much, because I wrote a piece on the site this week about it. It is just a very, very cool puzzle game, sort of sci-fi, paranoia, thriller puzzle game, wherein you play as it's not really clear who you are, but it's a first-person game where you go inside a machine that recreates memories. And basically, the early game is really cool. A lot of little puzzles that you solve to kind of figure out what's happening in this world. It's a sci-fi story about a potential like space travel, and maybe there's aliens, and there's some weird science shit going on, and there's a whole bunch of sort of just Cold War era paranoia sort of floating around the whole thing. And then the late game, very much like the first game of the series, just Assemblance, becomes this really, really intricate ARG-style kind of web of intrigue where you're trying to figure out little tiny clues and, you know, figure out all the codes that are written on the walls and things like that to kind of find new endings and to find other pieces of the much larger puzzle. Streamed it a little bit today, and I wrote about it yesterday, so I don't want to go overboard on it, but I love it. I really enjoy this kind of thing where, you know, the fun of it very much is in sort of plumbing its depths and messing around with variables and resetting things and kind of playing around with stuff. So really, really cool game that is a semblance oversight, and it's awesome.
Question for you.
Yeah, please.
So, like, one of my favorite experiences that I've had playing game in the last couple months was, like, when I went back and I played through Dishonored 2 again, this time I was like, fuck it, I have time, I'm going to solve the Jindosh riddle.
Yeah.
And it was really good. But I was like, man, I wish, like, there were sort of a game that, like, had a lot of exploration, environmental storytelling, and all that stuff, and stuff I enjoy. But also maybe through, like, really cool brain teasers. At me, like, is this that game, or is the nature of the puzzle very different?
I wouldn't call them brain teasers. I would call it more, it feels like science.
Okay.
This is a weird way of putting it. It feels like you're experimenting with variables. Basically what it comes down to is that there's like six or seven whatever environments, and you can change tiny variables in those environments and observe what those differences are, and sort of figuring out what those things are, what things to interact with in those environments, will give you different permutations on the environment and different things you can try and different things from there. So it's almost like variable science.
Yeah.
But within like trippy, mindfucky sci-fi kind of environment. So it's not like trying to solve spatial puzzles or anything like that, and it's not really like rhymes or riddles or anything like that, but it is, I think it scratches that itch, or it does for me, but it is not, you know, a one-to-one, I think, with the brain teaser sort of paradigm. But it'll tease your brain.
Yeah,
I'll tell you Yeah, I have a blast playing it. It's really fun. It's a good stream game, too, because your community can kind of get into it and like, oh, hey, have you tried making it red and then... Yeah, I'm trying to keep it vague, but
yeah.
You tried making the world red and then trying to make it blue and then, you know, trying to talk to the computer again, that sort of thing. Like, it's all about just messing around and seeing with what you can kind of interact with, which, you know, catnip for me, for sure. Awesome. So with our waypoints done... talking again, go listen to Radio Motherboard, they're good. We must sadly come to a close on this off-brand Idle Weekend / Waypoint Radio episode 157. Thank you, as always, to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint, we're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice, we're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice, and a cool video went up today, in fact, on YouTube, a video by Austin and myself. That is about State of Decay 2 and some really cool and weird stories that Austin kind of got himself into, the kind of fun trouble he got himself into in State of Decay 2. So you can check that out if you have a moment. And of course, you can read everything we write, and all of our good stuff goes up on waypoint.vice.com. Rob, where can people find you on the internet?
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.
Amazing. And if you want to, friends, you can follow me at Danielle R.I. Thank you all for listening. And we must sign off, of course, with the traditional Waypoint Radio greeting of be good and be good at it.
Oh, you can learn more about Idle Weekend at idleweekend.net. And no, sorry. Peace.
Good.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.